Well, good afternoon, Virginia. My name's Harold. I'm an alcoholic. It's a privilege to be here. It's fun to be here. I have a sobriety day of April 7th, 1987. I have a home group in St. Louis, Missouri. It's called AA on the Rocks. If you ever come to St. Louis, we hope that you look us up. Seriously, we meet on Wednesday night, 7 o'clock in the Shaw neighborhood in the city of St. Louis, strong through legacy AA group. And if you get a hold of us quick enough, we will put you to work. And I will get some mileage out of your sobriety, I promise you, if you come to St. Louis. 2030, we're having a party in our city. You coming?
Yes.
See international, you know, in our backyard. And if you're going to plan on coming, I would encourage you to come in a half hour or a day, a day early, because we'll have a pre-party party, you know, in St. Louis on Wednesday night before the big show starts on Thursday. So put that on your calendar. If you retired or you got an extra day of PTO, or you're just new and you don't have a job, you know, come and join us. I come from a great line of sponsorship, a strong three legacy group, strong three legacy sponsorship. All those things have made a huge difference now in my life's journey. And I'm grateful for that. And it has a Southern spin to it. And I'll talk. I did a little drinking in the South. I had, you know, a lot of sobriety from the South. And we'll get to that. I want to thank Billy for inviting me to come, and the committee for putting this together, and all those who made soups and salads and brownies and got here early to make coffee and all that stuff. It's such a beautiful event in a very historic space. Weather is perfect. Appalachian Mountains in the background. Strong sobriety here. Great shares from Ebony. Kicked us off. It was beautiful. It was articulate. It was full of gratitude and grace. So it was amazing talk. So thank you for kicking us off. Chris came up here and gave us the fire. Got us fired up. And he's got a lot of energy and passion for his recovery. And I'm grateful for that. And I got some of my favorite guys sitting right here in front row with Billy and Victor, Michael and David, some of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous who inspire me because of their commitment to this thing. And I was able to come in last night and hang out with one of my best buddies, David, and his wife, April, and go out on a boat ride on the Chesapeake Bay and hang out, eat some good food, go to his home group. And this is what AA is all about. If you come all the way in, sit all the way down and stay. Staying is the hardest part. It really is. Just out of curiosity, so we know who's with us, is there anybody here with less than a year of sobriety, a year or less of sobriety? Anybody?
There you go.
We got a few. Right. So, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and if you showed up here today with a treasure map looking for the X, you're sitting on it. You're sitting on the red X and to a whole new life. Not just any kind of life, it's a storybook. If you stay here, it really is a storybook life. You've heard two adequate demonstrations and just some powerful stories already this morning of what that story looks like. And it's not a fairy tale. It's if you come into this thing, it's amazing what happens in your life. I think as Bill Wilson wrote on page 105, there's a little excerpt from one of his writings, and Bill sees it. And I'm paraphrasing, but the title of the right in the middle of the page says Chief Responsibility. And it goes on to say, and I'm just paraphrasing for the sake of time, but it says that our chief responsibility is to deliver an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous to the newcomer. That's our chief responsibility, whether we're individuals, whether we're a group, a district, an area, this type of event, it doesn't matter. It's our chief responsibility when we get here to do that. And hopefully if you're new or you're trying to come back and re-engage and recommit to live a recovered centered life, that today is just that for you. It's an adequate demonstration of what life can look like, you know, without being under the care, custody, and control of King Alcohol. And that's what we hope for each and every one of you. I know that's true because in my experience of working with a lot of people over the years is that I know one thing about newcomers is that they listen with their eyes and they think with their feelings. And it's really important how we carry ourselves. And I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979 in the Department of Corrections. And I was taken from one facility, picked up on another charge, and brought to a new facility in northern Missouri. And I never heard of AA, never been to AA, didn't know anything about AA. But a couple of fine members came into that center where I was at, the detention center, and brought a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous into that space. I couldn't tell you anything I heard with these, but I can tell you everything I heard with these. And I didn't want what he had. I was far from conceding. I was powerless over anything, but it was the message. Now, I had a parole officer at the time who understood my condition way better than I understood my condition. And I had a prosecutor who understood my condition. And they offered me a very generous plea bargain. Here's the plea bargain. We can revoke your parole charge and send you back to where you just came from for 2.5 more years, or you can go into this treatment center for 30 days. Now, I quit school when I was 13, but I had enough math to know that 2.5 years was a hell of a lot longer than 30 days. So I'm doing 30 days. That was a quick plea bargain. Yes, put me in treatment. And by this time, it's 1980. Whoop, I'm into the treatment center. And I'm by, you know, you can just take this section here, half of it. And that's how many people were in that treatment center. Rural America, small town in northern Missouri on the Iowa border. And I was by far the youngest cat in that place, doing my time. And that's all I was there, is to do my time. AA back then, and I don't know about here, but there in my part of the world, was very big book focused. It wasn't real clinical at this time. You know, almost everybody there was that worked there were people just members of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 steps was the foundation, taking you to groups, having groups inside. They load you up on a van, they ship you off these little farm towns around us to go to AA. So my very first AA meeting outside of that treatment center, we were taken to a little town called La Plata, Missouri. And I walk in, and there's a woman. Just picture Santa Claus and his wife. Any portrait of that you want? Big white hair, rosy cheeks, right? Big smile that wraps around her head. This is the woman that meets me at the door. Her name is Millie Mays. Millie was awesome. She was a patriarch. She was a rock in recovery in the Midwest of Missouri, where I was at. Didn't know her. Never met her before in my life. But she invited me in. There was a pop machine, and we called it a pop. And she bought me an Orange Crush pop. A machine. I never forget. I had Orange Crush soda. I'm sitting there in my very first AA meeting. And there's just a handful of us in the meeting, mostly farmers, overalls, dusty, and working the field. And everybody had to talk. It was not an option. Everybody had to talk. And it came my turn. I said, "What do you guys say?" And I said something to the effect, "I'm only here because the Department of Corrections said I had to be here. And I only got a few days left, and you will never see me again. Because I'm not like you." And this beautiful Mrs. Claus looking figure grew horns, bangs, and a tail. Smoke shot out of her nostrils, flames shot out of her eyes. And she said to me, right to me, "Just keep drinking, you dumb little dummy, and it'll all happen to you." And she became my first resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you stay here, if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, the impossible becomes possible every day here. And 2 + 2 = 4. We call it spiritual mathematics. And many years later, when she had her 30th anniversary to celebrate at her home group, she invited me, the little Orange Crush punk kid, to speak at her group. That's how things come full circle years later. But I didn't stay sober, had no desire to stay sober. And back then, probably in Virginia, I think we're pretty much in a place where you could ride in the back of the truck. Can I get an amen on that? You could ride in the back of the truck. And that was my home plan. The boys pulled up in a pickup truck, cabs full, backs full. I jumped in the back, and we're off to one of the biggest parties I've ever been in my life. They hand me a big plastic jug full of Everclear and some Kool-Aid stuff. They called it jungle juice. They handed me some of that. They gave me some other things, something with Snoopy on it. I'm not sure what that was about. But we went to one of the biggest parties and best parties I've ever been to in my life, summer party. Summertime, girls, keggers, hog roast, southern rock bands. It was amazing. And the night I had that coin that I got for 30 days of sobriety, absolutely meant nothing to me. Definitely wasn't getting a car out of it. I could probably do that. But I like the way you say it. Overachiever. That's not what I'm talking about. And we walked down to the river with this coin, and I skipped it across the river, and I pounded my chest, and I made some hillbilly rebel yell. Like, I got victory over alcohol, treatment, DOC, everybody's with me. God bless America, and off we go. And that was the last time I thought about not drinking for a long time. But that was my introduction to recovery. You planted the seed. You know, I had no idea you planted the seed. And that's the thing, you know, when you're carrying a message, and Chris listed this up quite a bit. He says, when you're carrying the message and you plant that seed and you go out the next day and it's nothing, still bare earth. The next day you go out, it's still nothing. But one day you go back and all of a sudden there's a little sprout and you get to watch this thing grow. Well, that's the way it is in recovery. You don't always get to see the seed sprout. You know, sometimes you do. Sometimes you get to plant the seed, you get the water, you get to watch it grow, you fertilize it, you do all the stuff. And then you even harvest it. And you go on this incredible journey with that person. But sometimes you just plant seeds, but you'll never see sprout. And that's what happened in my case. I was born on the Oklahoma-Kansas border to the greatest mom that ever lived, Mama Long. It's the only parent I ever had in my life, active in my life. Didn't have any grandparents, never had any aunts or uncles. My mom was the full package. My mom was a woman who was married to two alcoholics in her life, the first one in St. Louis. She had a husband, all right, she had a husband and two daughters and a son that came out of that marriage. Total alcoholic chaos. I don't need to explain it, you guys get it. But through all that toxicity and all the insanity of that relationship, she left. She couldn't do it anymore. And she just left. I mean, left without really any notice. And for 10 years, my mom was gone. Nobody knew if she was dead or she was alive. She was just MIA, missing person. And she showed up 10 years later in a state mental hospital in the state of Missouri on that Kansas-Oklahoma border, very broken human being. She never talked about those 10 years of her life till the day she died. If you asked her about it, she, I don't know, I'm not talking about it. And she never talked about it. So nobody really knows what happened during that 10 years of her life. She met another guy, happened to be my dad, another alcoholic. And the race was on one more time. I came out of that marriage. Somewhere between two and three, my mom was just done. Done with alcoholic men, done with men, period. I never seen her ever date anybody the rest of her life. Now she probably did, but she never brought anybody home. I never saw with anybody till the day she died. But my mom had no resources, nobody to turn to, but she turned her will and life over to the care of God as she understood God, which was her Catholic roots, her Catholic faith. It's all she had. And she turned her life over to it and she never wavered on it. And she stayed with it. She continued to grow and her life continued to blossom. And she matured and blossomed into an incredible woman who has an amazing story in her own right and was a blessing to countless people, including myself. And she was the greatest winner in my life. She didn't have anything to offer me. We lived in a quadplex. We shared a bathroom with a lady next door. I didn't know we didn't have resources, but I had a mom who loved me. She told me she loved me almost every day of my life. Probably a good thing. I don't know that I'd be here if she didn't do those type of things. She wanted me to know about this Jesus-looking God that she followed. So she put me in a parochial school. And from kindergarten to the fourth grade, I went to a Catholic school. And I'm not one of these people that get up and say, you know, I was hurt by religion or I suffered church hurt or I'm a recovering Catholic. Not my story. As far as I know, I mean, I love church enough that I would come home and play church. I don't know if anybody here, anybody ever here play church? You can admit it. We're in a safe place. You can raise your hand. They all start doing that. But I would. I come home and play church. I get out TV trays for an altar, put a blanket over it, get some fruit bowl, fill it full of potato chips for the Eucharist, get some grape Kool-Aid for the wine, take a cheap towel out for the stole, a Bible out. We promise you, we never read that, but we had one. Looked good, and I'd invite a few souls over to the house, long of worship, save a few souls. It was a great day. This is how I'm starting out. You know, I'm a rock and roll drummer. I was gifted the gift of drums and percussion. Started playing music when I was five. Very gifted at it. I was in the rock operas were out. Tommy, Godspell, Hair, Jesus Christ Superstar. All this stuff is shaping who I am, what I believe, what I think, how I feel, how I react to it. I was a decent baseball player, a really good baseball player. Had I not found King Alcohol, I might have been able to play professional ball. I don't know if I'd ever been good enough to play for the Cardinals. But I probably could have played for the Cubs. Just saying. I could have played for the Cubs. The Cubs fans were flipping me the bird in case you don't see it online. But no, but that's how my life started out. There was no signs of any malady or anything in my life. And both Ebony and Chris did a wonderful job trying to explain the root of the problem. And if you're new, I know we have some newer people here. But I'll say it this way, and it sounds kind of like a paradox, but it's true. If alcohol is your problem, you're probably not alcoholic. Because if alcohol is your problem, just quit drinking, your life's going to improve and get better. But if you take away the alcohol and the malady that you heard explained here is still very loud in your head, and you need relief, which you heard both of our speakers articulate very beautifully. And you'll go to any lengths to get it, whether it's behavior, whether it's substance, you need something to take the relief away. that's alcoholism. And once I put it in my system, the mental obsession kicks in, the physicality starts, and I can't stop. And I just guarantee I'll ever stop the rest of my life. That's the nature of the beast. Well, that malady didn't really kick in until this day. And this day was, I was somewhere between 7 and 8 years old. My mom came in and says, look, sit down. I got something to tell you. I said, what's that? She says, we're moving. I said, we're moving where? She says, we're moving to St. Louis area. We're not moving to St. Louis. We're moving to the outskirts of St. Louis. And we're going to live in a trailer park. And I said, why? And she says, because you got a brother and two sisters you don't know about. And she threw a bomb on me. And she just opened a part of her life I didn't even know existed. And so it was just shell shock, really. You know, this chapter of my mom's life existed. And we moved to St. Louis. And we lived in this big old trailer park. We lived in the back where they called everybody trailer trash. We lived in a beat up old trailer. And and it was a step up from that old quadplex. And I had a whole room for my drum equipment. I had my own bedroom. So in a sense, it was a step up. But I was no longer sheltered in this little town, little rural America, a little school, less than 100 people. Now I'm in a public school system with thousands of kids. And the malady that we talk about, and you hear it, every speaker that gets behind this podium, I don't care who they are, they share it somehow, some fashion, some way, somehow describe this disconnect in their life. What do you want to call it? If you're a person of faith, you might call it a spiritual malady. If you're a person of reason, just call it separation, whatever, blockage, whatever. But whatever makes the world go around, whatever makes that little light and the lightning bugs light up at night, which we'll see for too long, I'm not connected to it. I'm disconnected from it. And it's that starts to take over my life. That I would call, you know, and Chris lifted the word up, delusion. But that's what I would call it. This delusion, I would call it the delusion of inequality. The great disconnect, that who I am is not enough. I could be better than, but most time, Chris believed it, the default is I'm going to think less of myself. And what you thought of me paralyzed me. Absolutely paralyzed me. I can promise you every tattoo, every scar, everything, every piercing I have in my life is because of that delusion. Every single one in my life. I'm talking about me personally. And so when I got there to this trailer park, I didn't look like anybody. I look like a country kid. You know, I look like a country kid from a country bunker compared. This is the hippie revolution. Everybody's hippies. Everybody's wearing bell-bottom pants, blue jeans, long hair. Everybody said, hey, man, what's up, man? Hey, man. You know, there's a total different vocabulary than that. How long do you think it took for me to shift? Not long. I had the bell-bottom pants for you. I grew my hair long. I got the Billy Jack black t-shirt. Billy Jack was a badass on TV. And I like Billy Jack, so I got a black t-shirt. I got the blue jean jacket. I ripped the sleeves off. I had a peace sign. I had a USA pack. Took the thumbtack out of my Kiss poster. Pierced my ear. So I had long hair. I had really bad gap teeth. I had freckles. I had pimples. I looked like some freaked out Alfred E. Newman portrait. Some freaked out version of Howdy Doody with long hair. If you don't know what those are, look them up. Just, and then put long hair on it. Use AI, put long hair on it. That's me. That's what I look like. Trying to just be a part of something. Because what you thought of me, paralyzed. Drums, music got me into a lot of spaces I didn't belong. My mom was always gone. She had no education, so she's always hustling, working two or three jobs all the time. So by the time I was 10, I did what I wanted to. I went where I wanted to. I hung around who I wanted to. And the music got me into dark circles, and I hung around some really broken people, older teens, people in their 20s, people in their 30s. And everything that you can use your imagination to think that would happen living in that world happened. Physical abuse, mental abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, going up picket. I experienced it all before I was a teenager. It's introduced to tobacco and drugs and booze. My mom drank her whole life. My mom always had the cheapest beer in the refrigerator. She always had a fifth of Old Crow underneath her sink the day she died. Some of the old timers call that the dirty bird. You know, that Old Crow. She smoked Virginia Slims. Did I ever steal some of my mom's tobacco? Did I ever smoke, you know, her cigarettes? Did I drink her liquor? Yes, probably. Ever drank some altar wine as a young Catholic kid? Sure. But none of that I would count as my first drink. But when I would talk about my first drink, and I think our speakers did the same thing. Others, Chris and Evan, both shared this. But I talk about the drink that changed my life. The drink that changed everything for me. And I was just turning 12. It's hard for me to believe because I have grandkids to say. Or I meet any kid that's a 10, 11, or 12, and they're so far disconnected from where I was. I mean, they're so far removed from where I was at. It's just hard for me to even relate to it, even all these years later. But But I went to my buddy Steve's house. He was a band member. His parents were in Florida, so he used to have the house to himself. He's playing the big shot. I go to my first party. I'm 12 years old. Walk in, and there's smoke, and there's dope, and there's girls. And he's behind the bar playing the big shot bar. And he asked me this all-important question. What are you drinking? And nobody had ever asked me that before in my life. I had no clue how to answer it. I said, I guess whatever you're drinking is what I'm drinking. And he goes, all right. And he made me a big glass of slow gin and Coke. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was in a green glass of ice. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I went over and sat on the couch, and the beat's going, and the vibe's in, the gay chatter, as Bill would refer to it, it's all over the place. And I finally get the courage to take a pull off it. And it tastes like cough syrup. And I said, this isn't that big a deal, man. And I hit it a few more times. And then the magic started happening. That warm sensation started to come over me. I started to get a smile on my face like I never had before. I hit it some more, and the smile grew bigger. I hit it some more, and eventually the smile wrapped all the way around my head. And it changed my life. And I didn't say it out loud. I didn't, like, make this declaration. But then my subconscious, I pretty much did. I'm going to do this for the rest of my earthly life. It gave me relief like nothing ever gave. It changed my life. I got as sick as I've ever been off alcohol. I said my first foxhole prayer that night, or plea bargain prayer. You know that prayer well. God, how's it go? God, if you get me out of this, I'll never do it again, right? And if you're really alcoholic, you've got to add this to it. And this time, I really mean it. Because you burnt that prayer to the ground. You burnt it to the ground. I didn't drink the next day, the next week, or the next month. But my life shifted that day. I wanted to live that life, every bit of it. It wasn't just a physical alcohol. It was the effect, the atmosphere, the connection, the community, all of it. I wanted to live it, and I set out to do that. It started that day, and I was hell-bent to do that for the rest of my life. Drinking, alcoholism, the progression, it happens in phases. It was fun, then it was fun with problems, then it's nothing but problems. Those seasons can last different phases, different lengths of time for different people. Drinking with problems came pretty fast for me. And it pretty much went to problems really fast after that. But I didn't have any money. We didn't have any money. It led to a life of crime. I'm not going to get into all that today. But it got me in a lot of trouble really quick with the police kicking in my doors before I was even a teenager. Destroyed my mom's life. Absolutely just destroyed my mom's life. And taken away. And I started my journey in the Department of Corrections before I was a teenager, you know, with the crimes that were committed. I left home when I was 15 years old for good, never to return. I grew up on the streets. I quit school when I was 13. I didn't have an education, and I just hustled my way through life. And I went from one space to the next space to the next space to the next space. And I hooked up with a guy named Scotty. Scotty was a drifter, gypsy, whatever you want to call him, from Austin, Texas. And he was in my little town that I was at the time. He had a step van, like an old UPS van that he lived out of. And he was on his way back to Texas. And somehow or another, I convinced him that it would be a good idea to take this kid that's not even 16 yet with him. And he agreed to do that. And off we went to Austin, Texas. Started my journey through the South. And I lived in Texas and Tennessee for a while, year after year. And it's just the same old, same old. Running from this place to the next place to the next place. Burning my life little bit by little bit to the ground. But in the early 80s, I ended up in Ackworth, Georgia. And at age 19 is when I had my first real, any kind of concession with this thing called alcoholism. Any kind of, any willingness or desire to not live this way anymore happened for me. I was a blackout drinker from day one. I had the seizures. My buddies called them the episodes. They would ask me, are you going to have an episode? You know, I don't know if I'm going to have this. I discovered the morning drink. The morning drink solved the seizure for me. And that started about 17. But at 19, I'm living in Ackworth, Georgia. And I'm living in this red barn trailer court with all the rejects from the South. There wasn't anybody from Georgia in our settlement. They're like from North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, you know, South Carolina, North Carolina. How bad was it? I lived next door to three guys named Porkchop, Hollywood, and Screwdriver. That should give you an idea. I don't have to say it anymore. If you're hanging around Porkchop, Hollywood, and Screwdriver, you might want to talk to your sponsor. Unless they belong to an AA club, then that's possible. Because that could be. That could be a true thing. But that wasn't that statement. But I was a blackout drinker. I played music in the clubs. I love the clubs. I love the saloons. You could easily call me a saloon attendant. Right? I lived in those places. And I had this gift, and I know some of you had this gift. I could tell by looking at you had this gift. That when you were out drinking hard liquor or mixing it with something else, that maybe, just maybe, good chance that somebody would want to punch you at least once before the night was out. Anybody have that gift? I had that gift. You know, I had that gift. So waking up with a pop now on your head didn't happen all the time, but it wasn't uncommon. It was Georgia. It was wintertime. I woke up. I had on cowboy boots, blue jeans, a flannel shirt, a beige vest. Woke up with a big tomato head. That's what we call a hangover in Atworth, tomato head. And I woke up with this big tomato head, and I had, when I set up from the, I didn't even make it to my bedroom. I set up on the trailer floor. I realized I had blood all over my jacket, all over my hands, dried blood. And I couldn't figure out what happened. And I figured somebody just kicked the dog's not nasty out. And I went into the bathroom. I'm trying to find out where I'm bleeding from. I can't figure it out until I start to get undressed. And I realize somebody sliced me all the way around my arm and stabbed me in my rib cage. To this day, I couldn't tell you what happened. But what I'm going to tell you next, and if you're new, and Chris really started to go down this road a little bit, but I'm going to take it just a step further. In the treatment world, in probably 70s and 80s, the word denial came out. You know, trying to describe alcohol. The word denial is only mentioned twice in the big book. Once on page 10 in Bill's story, and once in the spiritual appendix in the back. Both times talking about denying a pirate rating or so. The way our book describes alcoholism is way past denial. Denial is, I know Dave's sitting over there, but I'm not going to look at it. The truth's in the room. I know it's in the room. I'm not going to look at it. Denial, the way our book describes alcoholism is way past it. It talks about it on the basis of delusion and illusion. Meaning I can't see myself for what I really am, and I can't differentiate the truth from the false. And it's that delusion that will kill most alcoholics. 90% of the people who have alcoholism will never be in a space like this. They'll never be in a treatment center. They'll never walk into an AA meeting. 90%. And if you've been here for any length of time, you know that the 10% that do, less than 10% of them are going to stay. Why? Because of that delusion. This is what that delusion looks like in real life. And this is why if any of us ever drank again, why it's a good chance we would never draw a sober breath the rest of our life. And this is what it looks like. So the first time I walk out on that trailer, and I'm very emotional in there, trying to smoke a cigarette, paranoid, she can get, because I don't know what happened the night before. To this day, I can't tell you what happened. But I'm mumbling to myself, I got to do something different than what I'm doing. And it was as sincere as you can get. But if there's nothing between you and King Alcohol, and King Alcohol sitting next to you, and our founders personified alcoholism, they gave an old English character's name, John Barleycorn. It's like John Barleycorn sitting right next to me. I don't care what that represents for you. That represents spiritual warfare, the enemy, the dark side, the lower power, the devil, the Satan. I don't care. If there's nothing between you and it, and you're powerless over it, you're going to succumb to it every single time. As I sat there, there was nothing between me and King Alcohol. And I'm mumbling to myself, I got to do something different than what I'm doing. And King Alcohol says, yeah, I call him the great compromiser because he'll meet you where you're at. He said, you know what, kid, you're right. You do need to do something different. But before you do anything drastic, walk back here and grab your old army jacket and let's walk up to the magic market and get a quarter beer and a pack of smokes. It's the best advice I heard all morning. It's insane to anybody that would be standing there watching it. But it made sense. I got the old army jacket. I didn't even wash the blow off, man. It's a true story. I walked up to the magic market, and that sense of ease and comfort came over me before I ever got there. I'm already feeling better before I got there. And I get the booze. I get the cigarettes. I come out. I twist that top. Make that noise you all like. And that spirit of King Alcohol comes out of that bottle. I took a big pull of it. Made that pucker face we always make the first drink of the day. And that's the last time I thought about not drinking. For a long time. And I hitchhiked to Marietta, Georgia, got sewed up, and the game was on. That's alcoholism. And that's why most people who have it will never recover from it. I'm in the treatment centers every week, in the penitentiary every week. Have been for over 35 years. Worked with thousands of alcoholics over the course of that time. The cunning, baffling, powerful nature of it. And it's really that. You know, you just don't see the progression of how insane it is. But when you put it in context, you do. When you walk into the bar and you sit down and say, hey, man, I'd like to have a beer on draft. What's it going to cost? $2 today. sounds like a good price to pay. I'll pay that. And you'd pay it and you enjoy your cold beer till the next time you come in. And what's it going to cost you this time? Yeah, it's going to cost you your education. I don't sound like too big a price to pay. I'll pay it. And the next time you come in, what's it going to cost me? It's going to cost you your career. I don't sound like too big a price to pay. I'll gladly pay it. And the next time you come in, what's it going to cost you? It's going to cost you your relationships pretty much with everybody you care about. They don't sound like too big a price to pay. I'll gladly pay it. Then one day you walk in and say, what it's going to cost? It's going to cost you your health. You're going to compromise your health for the rest of your life. Doesn't sound like too big a price to pay. I'll pay it. And eventually one day you walk in and say, what's it going to cost me? It's going to cost you your life. It don't sound like too big a price to pay. I'll gladly pay it. And when you say it like that, it sounds completely insane. But if you're an alcoholic like me, hopeless ride, take your life, and it fits just like your hand. And that's alcoholism. And it's why it's so freaking painful to deal with it. We just buried a guy. Just buried a guy in my home group. A guy that I sponsored for three states over for 3 years. But through a series of compromise, early 60s, busy, working factory jobs, too tired. Man, I'm beat up here. We don't get it. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I can't hardly get going. I'm not going to make the meeting tonight. Not going to make the home. I got to get this grass mowed. You mean you don't understand it? You got all the stuff. You don't get it. And 2 weeks ago on a Sunday night, I got the text from his brother. They just found him at his house. We had the police go there on a wellness call. Found him behind the door of his front door, still barely breathing. Got him to the hospital. Died at the hospital. Cause of death: acute alcohol poisoning. He's a member of our home group. Just went to his funeral on Monday. That's the nature of the beast. His daughter called me and says, can you go by and get all of his recovery stuff out of the house? 2 days later, I went to his little house there in St. Louis with three totes, loaded them all up with AA books. He died right in the floor of that library. Had all the information in the world. Laying on the red X. Laying next to the fresh spring and dying, you know, from thirst. It's just the cunning, vast, and powerful nature. That's the malady that you've heard expressed here so well today. That is the root of the problem. I came back to St. Louis in 1985, and that's when my bottom really started to take hold. I got in 1987. I got arrested for a 4TWI conviction. 2 weeks later, I'm playing music over in East St. Louis on the other side of St. Louis for all the clubs and rock and roll bars and gentlemen clubs. It's where the nightlife is. It stays open all night long. So that's where we played most of our music. And come home at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm in the back seat, passed out in the car with my bandmates. I'm passed out. Where are you going? But we get involved in an auto accident and everybody in another vehicle lost their life then. And when I got home from that, the sun had been up for quite a while. And so when I came home from that accident, you know, I walked in my broken little apartment, my beat up little life. And I sat there and there was nothing between me and King Alcohol. Nobody to call, nothing to do. It didn't happen as fast as it did sitting in Red Barn Trailer Court. But it didn't take less than an hour before I was already in the refrigerator, finding relief one more time. And got behind the wheel of a car a few weeks later and got arrested for another DWI, which was for felonies, parole violation, and on my way back to Pennsylvania in 1987. So in that cage, in a cage is where I finally surrendered to this thing. And my prayer was simply three words. I don't even know if I said please. It was simply, God help me. And from that moment till now, I've never had another drink of alcohol. I got out of that cage. There was nobody to call, but I was able to finally get out. And I made my way back all the way to Northern Missouri, where I was at in 1979 and 80. Why? Because I listened with my eyes. That's where the seed was planted. It was familiar to me, and I was in a lot of trouble. I knew I needed to be able to stand in front of that judge and plead for mercy. And I went to the treatment center, not planning to do anything we're doing today, I can promise you. Long-term sobriety was not on my list, but I went there, and a guy came to my room. I said, yeah, he comes in, his name is Gary. I go, what's up? He's about 55, had on prison-issue glasses, big Kansas City Chiefs hat on. I said, what's up? He goes, hey, man, you're on the list. I said, the list for what? He says, you're a list to go to a meeting tonight. I said, what kind of meeting? He said, AA meeting. I said, I'm not going to AA meeting. He said, you're not going? I said, no, I'm not going. As politely as I could tell him to go away. And he left. And then he came back a few minutes later. It was beautiful. He opened the door and stuck just his head in. And he looked at me and he says, well, do me a favor. I said, what's that? He goes, why don't you try to smile and get it over with? And he left. And I thought about that. Nobody, I never heard that phrase. Nobody's ever said that to me before. But somehow or another, he got my confidence. And the next thing I know, I had energy and a willingness and a spirit about me that I didn't have minutes before that. So finally, I cracked the door and I started looking for the guy. I find the guy. I say, hey, man, you still going to that meeting? He goes, yeah, I'm still going. I said, man, that's awesome. He goes, why is that so awesome? I said, because I am going with you. He goes, that's fantastic. He was super excited. I said, why is that so fantastic? He goes, because I can't get anybody else to go with us. Right. And we knew I swallowed a hook. I don't know what I just said yes to, but it's not good. And the cool part about it, and you heard Ebony lift this up, 12 days for her. This guy had 2.5 months of sobriety. Yeah. He wasn't trying to be my sponsor. He wasn't trying to work the steps with me. But he was on fire for the 2.5 months he had. And he was willing to go any lengths to share it with me. And he was there to share it. Bill's got a term for it. It's on page 109 of 12 and 12. He calls it the magnificent reality of alcoholics. Even a brother who's just sober days can carry the message to his brother who's less than. And that's exactly what happened. So he got me to his car. We could pass a hat just in that section right there and pay for that car. It was an alcoholic car. It was an alcoholic car. And it's no exaggeration. It was a 1970 pea green Plymouth Duster. Floorboards rusted out, no exhaust, hot wire stereo, big old box speakers took up the whole back seat, trash everywhere, dust everywhere. And we get in this car, and we're in a rural town. And we're driving down where all the churches are at, because that's where AA is at, the church. And we're driving down there. Wham, 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 no exhaust in this car. It takes off, and carbon monoxide is pouring through the floorboard. They try not to die from asphyxiation. And he's got a big smile on his face because he's got the new guy. He's going to show up with street credit. He's got equity. He's got points. And he starts giving me the AA pitch, telling me how great his life is since he's quit drinking for 2.5 months. And I'm riding in this car trying to die from the carbon monoxide infection. And I think I coined a phrase right there. I'm like, dude, I hate to break it to you. It looks like your life sucks to me. That's what I told him. Exactly what I told him. But alcoholics are quick, right? He looks right at me and says, well, tell me about your car. He goes, the rumor has you got a big trial going on. How's that going to work out for you? He digged me pretty fast. Touche. Touche. When we get to the meeting, he goes, all right, now you're going to go in this meeting, and they ask any questions, but they even point to you. All I want you to say is your name's Harold and you're an alcoholic. Don't add anything to it. I go, what do you mean? He goes, you're from the Ozark Mountains, right? I said, yeah. And he said, well, you probably smoked some of that, huffed some of that, took some of those, but just be Harold the alcoholic. I mean, we know what that means. When you say alcoholic, it has a broad definition. And you're from the Ozark Mountains. It probably means you slept with a few farm animals, too. You already know. That's what he said. True story. And I'm trying not to laugh. I don't know what he's talking about. I'm like, just be Harold alcoholic. So I've been Harold alcoholic ever since. That probably saved me more fiasco with tradition Nazis and all that than ever in my life. Probably some of the greatest lists I've ever got in my very first meeting. But I walked in, and I got there. It was before the meeting started, and I sat down somewhere towards the front, and I sit next to a guy like Mike. And I asked this guy this question. If you're new and you got this question, it's a fair question. You don't have to apologize for it. But here was my question to this guy. How long do we got to come here? You know, and he's like, what? I said, how long do we come here? How long does this last, this AA thing? How long does it last? Is it like 60 days, 6 months? You know, I can do time. Just tell me how much time we're doing. And he was perplexed. But he was like, his response was brilliant. He looked at me and says, man, you got to come until you want to. And I'm like, I don't even want to be here tonight. I damn sure don't want to be here tomorrow. And I sure don't want to be here when I look like you. And now I look like that guy, you know, all these years later. But I came back to St. Louis and I didn't go to AA. I had that trial. That's all I cared about. I was going back to penitentiary. There was nothing going to really stop that. That's all I cared. I didn't go to AA. This guy that's persistent, my Ebby, you all have your Ebby. These people describe their Ebbies. I have my Ebby. Gary was definitely my Ebby. We didn't have smartphones, but he would call me on the landline. Did you go to AA yet? No. Why? I don't know why, Gary. And I really didn't know why. At the time, I couldn't articulate why. He says, Harold, your life depends on it. And I knew that was a true statement. I didn't want that to be true, but I knew it was true. And I finally got the courage to go. And to walk into my first meeting and raise my hand and say, my name's Harold and I'm an alcoholic, felt like a confession to me. It's one of the hardest things I ever did. My name's Harold and I'm an alcoholic. Are you happy? I said it. Be happy? Now don't talk to me. And I came to AA. And what I know all these years later, seriously, what I know all these years later, there's three types of people that come to AA. There's those who make it happen. There's those who watch it happen. And there's those who don't know what's happening at all, right? And I've been all three of those cats. I absolutely had no clue what was going on when I got here. But I watched AA happen. Chris expanded on that. Even, let me expand on that. What does that even look like? Well, I'm not going to get into it. You know what that looks like. But I was a social bug. I had a sober band called Alliance that rocked. I mean, it was an awesome band. Played on sober softball teams. Went to sober dances, chased sober girls. You saw me everywhere. You would have thought I was running for the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was everywhere. But I was on step none. And you're not going to stay in a 12-step program very long if you're on step none. We were at the International in Atlanta. I remember the person who shared on Friday night came out and said, you know, I did everything right in AA, but 12 things. And I started laughing because that's my story. Because I didn't understand the malady. I didn't understand spiritual separation. I didn't get that was my problem. I was under this mindset that booze is my problem. And booze hasn't been in my life for 3 years. But the malady is still killing. And my life really hasn't gotten any better. But if you take physical alcohol out of your body, you're going to get physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually a little better, just by default. And so that happens. So I think I'm doing okay. But the reality of it wasn't. And so I finally humbled myself to sponsorship. And it took me almost right at 3 years to do it, to finally grow up. I had a probation and parole officer since I was 11 years old, and I still had one. So the last thing I was doing, asking anybody to have say-so in my life, it wasn't interesting. You can keep the sponsor, man. I'm not interested in the sponsor. But I finally had to humble myself. And I went and asked this guy. His name is Roy. I could walk to his house. That's why I asked. And he knew me my whole sobriety. He had about 13 years at the time. I went to Roy's house, and I sat with Roy. He was gracious. And I sat with him. I said, Roy, will you help me? Yes. Let's talk about you. You've been around for almost 3 years now. Tell me about your life. I said, I'll tell you about my life, Roy. I'm 25 going on 26. I don't have an education. I don't even have a GED. I got a criminal record. I don't know if I'll ever have a legal driver's license the rest of my life. I got a piece of crap car held together by bumper stickers that I can't legally drive, but I do anyway. I live in a beat up house up the street in the basement. I don't have a girlfriend, and my job sucks. Take the word sucks, capitalize it, highlight it, italicize it, make a neon sign out of it. That's my life. And I vomit that all over his table. And he graciously listens to it. But what he said that day was as true that day as it is as I sit here with you today in Virginia. He said, Harold, I hear everything that you have to say today. And I'll be the first one to admit you've been dealt a pretty tough hand in your life. But I hope you're going to hear what I'm going to tell you. That everything you have in your life right now, sitting at this kitchen table, every single thing you have in your life, you've attracted to you by the person that you become. And today you're man enough to own that truth. Is the day you're on your way to some real change. But until you can own that truth, this vicious little cycle you're on, you're going to eventually drink again because you're not happy about it for sobriety. You're like a boy whistling in the dark. You do anything to drink and get away with it. He says, so you're going to do one or two things. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And it sounds like an easy question, but I knew he was going to say, let's work the steps. And the problem with the steps, and if you're here tonight and you're struggling with the steps, I can just solve the mystery for you. What's the problem? It's you don't believe it'll change your life. Because if you believe it would change your life, there's nothing I can do to keep you. And if you don't think that's true, just switch the formula around. Just apply it to your alcoholism. You were willing, you know, because if I would ask you, what does it mean to believe in something? I think ultimate decision is I'm willing to die for it. How much did you believe in King Alcohol? Were you willing to die from it? Seconds and inches all the time from dying from it. You could go to any lengths. There was nothing that could keep you from it. So the reason you struggle with this spiritual design for living, this spiritual principle way of life, this design for living, this really works, because you don't believe it's going to change your life. Because if you did, you would have been stopped. But you got to come to the end of yourself. both our speakers talked about that you have to come within yourself. For some people, it happens today to put down the booze. They're all in immediately. There's people here, that's their story. I came in today, hey, I was done. I put down the booze, got the sponsor, worked a step, changed my life, been here ever since. Been a great ride. For others, like myself, I just didn't understand what we were up against. And it took everything I could concede that King Alcohol was something that I couldn't participate with anymore. But that's where I thought I got off the train. And I didn't realize the depth of what I was up against. So he said, you're going to either drink again or you're going to do what your dad did. My dad was an alcoholic who never got sober. At age 54, my dad took his life. That's how my dad quit drinking. So you're going to grow or you're going to go. What are you going to do? And say, I knew he was going to say, let's work the steps when we started that journey. And his taste is so good, I never stopped from that day for that. And it totally transformed my life. It only got a few minutes left. I don't have time to get into all of what happened in my sobriety, but a gentleman named Tom I, some of you know Tom or knew Tom, some of the old timers from North Carolina, stayed away, was my sponsor, a big chunk of my sobriety. He's really had an influence on my life. But Tom had a beautiful, beautiful definition for a miracle. Here is his definition. When preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction, great things can happen in your life. But if you're not prepared for the opportunities, it isn't that they're there. They just wave on. They wave at you when they go by because you're just not prepared to receive them. I wasn't prepared at that time, but I started the journey. And it tastes so good, it never stopped. And it didn't happen in one big cataclysmic explosion. But little by little, my life started to come together. The impossible became possible. 2 + 2 didn't equal 4 anymore. And it just started to happen. Things started to happen. And all kinds of things happened. And the easiest way to summarize it as I wrap up here is that just look at S&P 500 fund. From 1925 till now, it's up. Is there a few recessions? You bet. There's been a few recessions. But it's up. It's been my life. And I can get into the weeds with you about the rest of it. But, you know, I became a dad in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never knew I could fall in love with a little bald-headed woman with no teeth until you handed me one. So here you go. You're responsible for the rest of your life. Not once, not twice, not three times, not four. Five times. Four girls, one boy. Have an awesome wife named Susie, who's dealing with tree tremors at our house today back in St. Louis. I got a black lab named Coda. I got four grandchildren. Two were adopted from Mexico. They were the first two. And that was an oldest daughter living in Houston. Saw a need of a woman who was raising autistic children, adult autistic children, and left with these two kids because of their addict, alcoholic parent. And she's trying to raise three autistic children plus two little ones. She couldn't do it anymore. Daughter and them got moved, went to the house, said, can we help? They said, yeah, because DFS is coming Monday to pick up these two kids. I don't know what else to do with them. They said, well, don't do that. We'll take them for at least a little bit. They were 2 and 4. They're 9 and 7 today. You know, they become part of our family. And I was telling Mike and Victor, last Father's Day, I got a beautiful card from the daughters that they always do. And in the card, one of the pieces said, Dad, thank you for showing us how to love the unlovable. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, growing up in the rooms with guys staying at our house, being in our kitchen table all the time, book studies, breakfast, evenings out of the house and home, all the stuff. And still are today. But they grew up in this thing called A. I went back to school. I got a job. My mom, after I made amends to my mom offered me a job to come work for this national insurance program. I said, Mom, they're not going to hire me. I don't even qualify to take out the trash. She said, don't let me worry about that. Don't you worry about it. Long story short, I went there and I got this job working for her. And then a year later, they offered me an opportunity. I went back to school. I got a bunch of initials behind my name. And eventually in my 30s, I couldn't go any further because I didn't have any formal education. So I had to go back and get a GED. Now I'm sober a dozen years by now. And so I couldn't pass it. I tried to pass it while I was incarcerated a couple times, but I couldn't do it because I quit school too long. So my sponsor said, go to school. So I went to community college for 16 weeks, and they thought I was a professor when I showed up. But long story short, I finished it, and I went on to college, and I walked across the stage, and I got a bachelor's degree, and I was able to stay on the dean's list and then walk across the stage and get a master's degree and write a thesis and start a business from scratch. And I did that not once, not twice, but three different times. And able to walk across the stage and get another master's degree, and really close to walking across the stage and getting a doctorate. It's been a storybook run, but I want to leave you with the medicine, the magic, of what really changed my life. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, making amends was a big part. Making amends to my mom, who died in 2015. When we were in her hospital room, she got stage 4 lung cancer, small cell lung cancer. She lived 8 days from the diagnosis. But when we were all in her room, right before she died, I'm in there with my siblings, my half-siblings, grandkids, kids. We're all piled in this room, nephews, before COVID. And as I looked around the room, I knew I was good with everybody. I didn't know anybody, nothing. We had reconciled with everybody. We, you know, most of these people never even knew I drank. Totally restored in my life. The night before my mom died, I put headphones on her ears for the last time. And she woke up with death in her eyes. You could see the death in her eyes. And she was startled. I said, don't worry about it, mom. I'm just putting on some earphones. I'm putting on your favorite singer, Frank Sinatra. She loved Frank Sinatra. And I said, I'm just putting on a little Frank Sinatra. My mom's last words were, everybody needs a little blue eyes. So I got a big picture of Frank Sinatra with that quote at the bottom of the film. But my siblings asked me if I would do a eulogy for my mother, which was the hardest talk I ever gave my mother. She was definitely the greatest player in my life. My dad never, you know, I only saw my dad a couple of times. The last time I saw him, I was 14 when I got sentenced to the penitentiary for the first time. He came to the trial for that. But as I made an A-step list, and I had my A-step list on 3x5 index cards, one of those people on my list was my Uncle Bob. And that's my dad's brother. And I didn't want to put him on there. I only met the guy once when I was about 5. He says, put him on there. And so year after year, he would go through the bank. So 5 years sober, 10 years sober, 12 years sober. Now I'm down to just a stack of cards, just a few cards left. I'm in the penitentiary one night. We're doing a 12-step workshop there. And I mentioned this thing that we were on the 8th and 9th step. I mentioned my hesitation with this Uncle Bob one. And one of the guys, one of the members on the inside said, dude, when are you going to just shut up and do it? I'm like, man, I bring this meeting in here. You know, I'm ready to fight. You know? But I knew he was right. And I went home that night and I Googled. I don't even know if this guy's alive anymore, but I Googled Robert and Betty Long. Buffalo, Missouri. So it's got to be Mama Bob. So I write a card, write a little note, tell them why I'm trying to find them, send it. They send a card right back. A couple of days later, my Aunt Betty calls. She says, this little Harold, I guess that's what they called me when I was a little boy, but my dad's name is Harold. So this little Harold, I said, this is him. This is your Aunt Betty. Did you get my card? I said, yes, ma'am. She says, well, see, I could tell she was excited. I said, well, I really need to come and see you in person to make this amends. She goes, I'm not really worried about all that mess stuff, but we would love to see you. Please come. So I drove to Buffalo, Missouri. And our book says that 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens when we're doing this work. We're properly sponsored and where our spiritual motives are right. My experience has been 10 out of 10. But I went there and I drove this little town, 3,300 people, pulled into a driveway, 4-car driveway, 3 cars already there, 1 spot for me. And I get out and I'm looking. It's a 1-story ranch home. I'm looking, there's cars both ways on the street. I said, man, these people got a lot of cars. And I get out, my Aunt Betty comes to the front porch, little sawed-off country woman. She's got a big smile. She goes, well, he looks like a long, you know, my heart's pounding through my chest. And then I walk up on the front porch. And my Uncle Bob comes out. And he grabs my hand. And he put his other hand right on top of it. And he squeezed it. He looked me right in my eyes. He says, welcome home, son. Come inside, I got some people you want to meet. And went inside, and every one of his kids, grandkids, cousins, probably over 30 people, were there to welcome me back into their life. And I call it something. And what I tell you is that the malady is real is because that was available day one. This is 12 years later. Resisting life front on self can hardly be a success. So it's been a powerful journey. But I want to leave you with this. I was told two things. Do you want to have a storybook life? This is how it was pitched to me. Do you want to have a storybook life? Well, how are you going to say no to that? I don't even know what that means. Do you want a storybook life? Yes, I want a storybook life. Then do these two things consistently for the rest of your sobriety, and you have a storybook life. Number one, you always have a new guy you're on this journey with. If you don't have a new person you're on this journey with, you stop what you're doing. You get out your rod, you get out your bait, you go fish for your fish, but you always have a new guy on this journey. No exceptions. Page 100, first full paragraph. Don't have time to read it. Read it on your own. One of the most powerful promises in the book. Number two, you got to go somewhere once a week you don't want to end up. I don't care where it's at. You just got to go. And that started in the Salvation Army for me in 1990. And I've held true to those two things without any compromise all these years later. Those have been the two things I've done consistently that have changed my life. Started in the Salvation Army Skid Row mission. In 93, I got a call. A guy says, "Hey, man, you want to come out and speak at this prison for me?" I started laughing. I said, "Dude, you know who you're talking to?" And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "They're not going to let me come out to the prison. Are you out of your mind?" He goes, "Man, I got a lot of pull wire. I've been here a long time." He goes, "You're off paper now, right?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Yeah, I can get you in." I said, "Well, let me put it this way. I made a pact a long time ago that I ain't ever, ever, never, ever going back on that side of the cage for you or anybody else." He goes, "Yeah, yeah. Run that by your sponsor. Call me back." So, you know, I was. And so I went and then eventually became, you know, a volunteer in corrections and have been that for over 35 years. And I'm in a maximum security prison every week, have been for 35 years, and has some tremendous stories out of that. Some of those stories you probably heard at podiums or from conferences. So some of the guys that I sponsored that came from those places. It's been a storybook run. That's my life. I wouldn't change it for anything. So I'll end you with this. Page 152 says this, and it's a fair question. Here's the question. Do you have a sufficient substitute for King Alcohol? Because, man, I need relief. I got to have relief or I'm jumping off a cliff. So do you have a sufficient substitute? Not a more fair question than ever. And the answer is yes. And it's what? Vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you look at the word fellowship, it's in the verb form, meaning that you have to participate in your own sobriety. It's a program of action. And there your imagination will be fire. You know, the most, what? Stories of your life or your existence. But most important, the most important part of it for me, and I'm summarized, you're going to have the privilege to walk shoulder to shoulder with other people and help them rediscover life. And if you do that long enough, you're going to finally know what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. You're going to move from a taker to a giver. And in my experience, if that doesn't happen, you ain't staying here. Because you're going to get sick of how it works. You're going to get sick of the preamble. You're going to get sick of hearing Billy share the same thing. Vic say the same thing. Mike share the same thing. Ebony shared the same thing, and Chris shared the same thing, and Dave shared the same thing. I don't want to hear it. I can tell you what they're going to say before they say it. You're going to get sick of it. And through a series of compromises, you're not going to be here. And then the pain is going to come back, and the irritable, restless, discontent is going to come back. And believe it or not, you will either through behavior or substance find your way to relief, which will end up burning your life. I know that today. So I just keep living this journey. So you gave me these four principles to live by. I really try to live by these four principles. Number one, live a life of humility. And that doesn't mean that you don't have goals or ambitions. You can try to grow your 401k. You don't go back to school. It means that you live for something other than yourself. It means that you put God's ambitions ahead of your own. You live a life of self-sacrifice. You live a life of other-centeredness. And most importantly, you go out and try to love everybody, even the people you don't care for. You gave me that way of life. That's what I get up to every day. That's what I give her hell with every day. It's led to a pretty incredible life. I think I'll keep living it. I don't have time to stick around. We got to burn immediately to the airport. But I want to thank Virginia. I want to thank you. I want to thank Billy. I want to thank this committee. I want to thank this conference. I want to thank this spirit, this fellowship, this spirit right here for the opportunity to come. But most importantly, thank you for my life. And that's all I got.